Hi, and welcome to another CineStories podcast. I'm your host, Brian Dick. Recently, I sat down with Adrian Biddle, producer at Unbroken Pictures, where she has teamed up with writer-director Brian Bertino. In the past few years, they've produced Mockingbird, The Black Coat's Daughter, and the soon-to-be-released movies There Are Monsters and Stephanie. During our conversation, we discussed her journey traversing the wild waters of being an industry assistant to a young exec to a producer. And since we met her at her home, we also spent some time dodging a cat who decided to crash the party and ignoring her ringing landline that couldn't be silenced. Apologies for the interruptions. But before we get into the podcast, a bit of business. Right now, CineStory is accepting submissions for its 2016 feature retreat and will be doing so until April 5th. If you're a student or a recent graduate, email us from your school account and we'll provide you with a student discount code. Also, for more information, please visit our website, www.cinestory.org. Now, on to my conversation with producer Adrian Biddle.
We are now officially recording.
Oh my God.
We are podcasting.
We are officially podcasting. My first one, by the way.
Well, thank you.
So thank you.
I guess I always like to start with where people fall in love with movies. Like, what was it? How did you get into the industry? Was it a love for movies when you were a kid? Did you always know you were going to be in the film industry?
No. You know, it's weird. Like, if I look back on my life, I think I've always evidenced a sort of... I mean, I worked at a video store. That was my main job when I was in high school. But it wasn't because I just loved the movies. I think it was like VHS. I mean, I'm dating myself now, but VHS were, you know, new, and I was there. And I remember my attitude... towards films was, because I get the movie rentals for free, I'm going to take all the ones that I'd never, ever pay to see home. So I watch things in big showy boxes like, you know, I Spit on Your Grave and Microwave Massacre. I don't remember any of those movies, but I always managed to pick the genre movies because all the fancy dramas or whatever, I was like, I'd pay to see that. So maybe I'll go to the theater, but if I'm here, I'm going to, you know, I'm cheap. So
right.
That was my thing. So then I sort of never really thought about it much after that. Music was my thing. I wanted to be in the music business. And, but then when I went to college, I sort of took this very analytical approach to all of it, which was, you know, movie making is a very collaborative medium and it's not an entirely artist-driven medium. Meaning in the music business, you need a band. So you have, and that's probably not entirely true, but to my uninitiated mind, that's kind of what it felt like. So I thought if I wasn't an artist, if I didn't write, if I wasn't a director, and I had no idea what really any of these jobs other than those things, actor, writer, director, right, you know, did, you know, could I still be around interesting creative people? And the only place that I saw that I might be able to do that and still hold my head high and not think that I was just a glorified babysitter was the movie business. I didn't have that thought until I was 26. Before that, and when I was thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, I remember going to see Jurassic Park. And it was like I'm from Washington, D.C. And so it was like the big, beautiful red curtain theater, you know. And I remember being so excited about the movie because I'd read the book and I loved it. And, you know, dinosaurs, and it was just so cool. And I you know, I wasn't young. I mean, I was probably in, you know, maybe early college when I saw it. But I remember sitting in the theater, and in certain cities, they had created like special speaker systems because they've been trying a new sound, you know, thing. And this theater was one that got the extra speakers.
Was that THX? Was that when that was coming out?
Yeah. You know, and again, I didn't pay any attention. I just knew that it was like some cool thing. So I was in the theater and I remember sitting in my chair and I was looking at the red velvet curtain and I was so excited. I mean, just so excited. And the curtain parted and I was like thrumming with excitement. And when I looked back on that, when I was thinking about what I wanted to do, I was like, I want to make somebody feel like I did that day. Like, I'd like to make a movie where, you know, I'll never forget when the T-Rex puts his foot down and the whole theater, just the bass just shakes and it's in my, and I felt it in my gut. And I was just like, that's just amazing. And most people have that with Jaws or Star Wars. I know lots of, you know, people in the business that, you know, I remember standing in line, like, I never cared about any of that at all, you know?
Yeah.
But Jurassic Park was my first real memory of like being profoundly just in it. And looking back, I was like, I want to do this for someone else.
And it's amazing that movie, the graphics and the computer generated CGI is still holds up. I mean, it still looks like it could be released today.
It's crazy.
And you buy it. Yeah.
Well, and you know, and at the time, much like I imagine when the kids that all saw Star Wars in the theater, I was not one of them, being like, I can't believe this is real, you know? And I remember seeing Jurassic Park and being like, they look like living creatures, you know?
Yeah.
And how blown away, because I wasn't inundated with that, because it was still in such, you know, the digital effects were not spectacular at that point. They'd certainly gotten much, much better, but right. That had really sort of felt like it took it to a whole new level. But yeah, so I mean, I started to get a master's in finance, thinking that, again, with my logic on, I could go and do something on the business end of things and be around this interesting, glamorous environment. And about halfway through my degree, my mom was on the internet one day and came across the Peter Stark program, which is the graduate producing program at USC, and looked and was like, you don't have to have been a film person to apply here. You know, they actually look for people with disciplines outside of film. And I had been a project manager for a nonprofit in Washington for, you know, a number of years. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I guess like producing sounds a little bit like project management, you know, it's basically the same thing. So I applied and I got in. And when I came here, I realized that there was a place for someone like me, who I was a voracious reader. I have the ability to articulate why I like and don't like something. And knowing what development was the first time I'd understood what that word even meant, and thought, you know, I am creative, just not in a way that, you know, again, to the uninitiated, you would think would be useful. I mean, I always sort of, when I explain to someone who isn't in the business, I'm like, I'm kind of like an editor. Like a book editor, you know,
right.
I can read something and I couldn't write it, but I can tell you why I'm feeling the way that I'm feeling and why I'm not feeling the way that I'm feeling and offer suggestions that may not be burning up the barn with their amazingness, but often will spark a conversation for the true talent in the room, the writer, to sort of be like, oh, okay, I can use that as a reference, as an example, and then come up with a way better idea.
Was there a class there that you felt sort of developed that for you? That sort of, you know, maybe,
you know, the class that has stuck with me the most, truly, my teacher's name was Babette Buster, and she, I've told her this story, so I'm not speaking out of school, but universally, everybody in my class hated her. And the reason is that she was basically telling us, these pretentious, totally non-film people who just got all excited about being in film school, that scripts follow a structure. And we're like, no, you can't box art in. And that's ridiculous. And, you know, and you know, you have to, and at the time, again, I'm dating myself, but at the time it was like three-hole punch, have to have covers, need to use brass brads, don't buy the bullshit cheap ones, get the real brass. You know, Courier 10, like, don't fuck around with Times New Roman. Like, so there was this rigid sort of approach that she was explaining to us that writing took.
Right.
And we just thought it was bullshit. We were like, no, you're lying. Like, this is art. And then so all semester, she basically over and over and over again said, here's where it breaks down. And we all discovered, and I remember my, you know, the class about 25 people. And so at the end of when we graduated and we all had a party, I remember a bunch of us, maybe 3/4 of the class had gotten together and had this discussion that Babette's class was the most useful class that any of us had taken, and that we all realized that she was right. And it was, and it just chapped our ass that she was right, you know, but she was right. And that really, that taught me how to analyze scripts. It taught me how to read scripts. It taught me how to look for certain things. And in the process of that, once you sort of understand that language, and again, experiences, is, I mean, I've read thousands and thousands and thousands of scripts. I mean, I've been in the business for 17 years and, you know, you read a lot of scripts over that time. And I'm also a fast reader, and so it helps. But I mean, you know, that when the structure becomes second nature to you, mm-hmm. then the creativity can flourish. Then you're not confused anymore about whatever. And so you can start focusing on ideas or whatever. And so I think throughout the course of her class, that was when I started to sort of find my own voice creatively and say, oh, well, this is missing a beat here. And what was I missing? What did I want to see? And then it forced me to kind of think of things that I wanted to see in those spaces.
Right.
So it was, I mean, to this day, I use it every day. You know, it was a great class.
And then when you got out of Stark, they're usually, I mean, the people that come out of Stark usually are able to get desks at,
you know,
larger companies. Where did you go straight into being an assistant?
Well, I mean, and again, I had had a professional career before, and I remember asking one of the teachers this question. I was like, well, you know, I've been a professional in the past. Will that help me? And she was like, nope. and so I was prepared to start at the very bottom. What I didn't want to do was be an intern forever. So one of the nice things about Stark is that between the first year and the second year, they set you up on an internship program. So there's a pool of places that will actually take you.
Right.
So I did in my internship at New Line. And at the time it was when Mike DeLuca was still running the company, and it was like the hottest place in town. And they were making genre movies. You know, he was known for it. I mean, in that era, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, like,
okay.
Was
that before Austin Powers or?
Right around the time. I think Austin Powers had come out and maybe they were making the second one.
Okay.
And so, you know, those were all the movies that I used to rent at the video store and take home, you know, those kind of, you know, glorified B movies. I never looked at them as B movies. And obviously the movies that are on everybody in his grandmother's top 10 lists, you know, whether it's The Exorcist or The Shining or Jaws, these are genre movies too. You know, people just don't like to call them that because they were successful and genre movies are treated disrespectfully, in my humble opinion. But anyway, so I was at New Line and the woman and I had one of the assistants that I was helping out went on vacation. And so he was like, do you want to sub for me while I'm gone? So I was like, sure. And so the woman that I was working for, her name was Lynn Harris, she was very good friends with Stacey Scher, who was a former Stark grad. So Stacey had called Lynn and said, I'm looking for an assistant. And Lynn was like, well, this girl's on my desk and she's in the Stark program. And so I was lucky enough that I went and I interviewed with her, and she was, she still is, but at the time was a very big fancy producer and had two assistants. So, the fact that I was in school, Stark was at night the second year. So she was willing to let me be on her desk and have to leave every day and go to school because she had somebody else to take the place. So anyway, I got that job.
Well, that's a testament to you, because any executive that allows an assistant to leave to go back to class, I mean, I've never heard that before.
I think that was, I really lucked out because she was a Starkey.
Yeah.
So she understood the program. She understood what it was, like respected it. She'd always been a mentor to the program. You know, I think she thought I was good too, but I mean, I didn't come here to be an assistant. So I realized very early on that I was good, but I had aspirations. So I probably wasn't the best assistant. A great piece of advice that I've given since that time, I learned so much from Michael Shamberg and Stacey Scher, who were my two primary points of contact. Stacey was obviously my direct boss, and I was at Jersey Films for 4.5 years after that job. So, but I always tell people, if you want to move up quickly, go work for someone who has a reputation for being difficult. And the reason is the turnover is very high. So on the day that I graduated from Stark, I got promoted to story editor because the vice president and the story editor quit within a week of each other. whereas if I'd stayed at New Line, I would have been on a desk for 5 years because everybody stayed because it was such a great company to work for. And, you know, Stacey and Michael were very tough taskmasters. And so a lot of people just couldn't cut it. So I just kind of went home and cried at night and hung in there, you know, and I got promoted after 6 months.
So were you just almost winging it at that point? Or did you feel like you had a pretty good grasp on the role of story editor and
I remember, like, you know, you roll calls for your boss and you've got your call sheets. And so you've got names and phone numbers and you figure that out. And I remember my first day when I was sitting in I was in a closet. I was sharing a closet with someone else, literally a closet. They'd converted a closet. That was my office. And I was sitting there looking at that phone and I was like, and now what the fuck am I supposed to do? You know? And you realize nobody knows who you are.
Right.
You know, everyone takes your call when you're like, I have Stacey Scher calling.
Yeah.
But when, you know, you, oh, it's Adrian Biddle. They're like, who? So, you know, it was, and again, I'm going to digress slightly, but in my past life, I sold insurance for a little while and I was a very good salesman. But I was terrible at cold calling. I just couldn't do it. I hated the rejection. I hated all of it. It was just the discomfort of knowing that you're bugging someone, that they don't want to talk to you. And so if somebody got me in with a warm room, I did a great job. But I eventually just couldn't hack it. And being a story editor was very much like that. Like,
right.
Here I was having to cold call these people who nobody wanted to talk to me. And it toughened me up a little bit, but I was at sea. I had no concept as to what I was doing, really.
Well, and that was the first time you probably started working hands-on with other writers, right? I mean, because
yeah.
If you're on a desk, that's, you know, you're so focused on the needs of the executive, it doesn't really lend that much time to it. So,
well, I think that, you know, if you, I love to read. So I read a bunch of stuff, mm-hmm. and I liked to write down my thoughts about those things. And that's not true. I didn't like to write them down, but, you know, being able to have someone listen to what I thought was nice, and the way to get people to listen is to put them in a document that then they can edit and pass off as their own, but, naming the names, but anyway, and, you know, and you develop a voice doing that because,
yeah.
You know, and at first you're like, this sucks. And then your boss is like, you can't say that, you know? And so, and you know, I also would hear the people that couldn't get her on the phone,
yeah.
You know, writers who, you know, had projects or that some other executive and someone was calling or an agent wanted to submit a script and then Stacey would pawn it off to another executive.
Right.
And that's the way it works. So that's not saying that she was, I mean, that's what you do. I do that now, you know? And so those calls, I formed relationships with agents that didn't kind of, hadn't moved up the food chain themselves. And so, you know, you, and I knew that the ticket was to start reading and to start formulating my relationships with those agents and start getting to know those newer writing clients who spoke to me in some way and that they might not be as polished or whatever, but that if I could work with them or talk to them and just understand the process a little bit, that that would be a great way for me to move up myself, you know?
Right.
And I always remember thinking that, people get upset when they go down to the lower person, you know, they can't get the big name on the phone. And so they, and I'm like, who do you think does most of the work? Like, and at the end of the day, you always want a junior fighting for you.
Right.
Because it's in their best interest to make something happen. Whereas the senior has already got a lot on their plate and, you know, that's kind of how it works. And so, you know, you, excuse me, a cat is on the table. I'll move this off. So it was good, and I did the work, and people liked that because
yeah.
I would talk to them, and you know, and I understood the symbiotic relationship between a junior agent and a junior executive, and that eventually, I mean, my agent now is an assistant that I used to talk to,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's now a partner at UTA. Like, so it's, you know, they always talk about your class, like those relationships that you form. They may not be fancy, but you don't want them to be fancy. You want to grow together because you will grow. If you can last long enough, you'll grow together.
Right.
You know, whether that's writers talking to each other or writers getting to know young producers or whatever, like, you know, that those are the people that will have your back because we all will remember when we weren't quote important, you know, not that any of us are important now, but you know what I mean?
Well, you know, how to all plate, you know, plate food for your boss and,
totally.
You know,
I mean, you know, it's like, I remember when you were throwing up at the condo in Sundance and it was really embarrassing. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so when you remember what someone looks like, you know, and then they're in their fancy suit running a meeting, you're like, you know, it just kind of makes it levels the playing field. It's nice. I mean, they become your family, you know, in its own weird way.
Was there a project at Jersey Films that you had always wanted to see get made that you just weren't able to convince them of?
Well, you know, yeah, there are two. One was sort of a team effort that was more intimately, I was more intimately involved with. I was also a little bit higher up the food chain at that point. And then the other one was sort of by the grace of God, I just kind of latched on and I became kind of the work, the day-to-day grunt workhorse with the writer. That one was called Revelations, and it, Danny DeVito was going to direct it. George Clooney was starring in it. Shane Salerno was writing it. I think Michael Petroni might have written the original script or whatever, but a lot of big players at the time involved. And it was a, you know, biblical sort of horror movie set at the Vatican in Rome. And it was awesome. And they went scouting for it, and Warner Brothers was going to do it. And I, Shane and I got along very well. And so I was just sort of his day-to-day in terms of going back and forth with the script. And for a thousand different reasons, the movie eventually just sort of didn't go. But I mean, they scouted, like my very good friend, Ian, who was Danny's assistant at the time, you know, he went to Italy with George and Danny and did the crazy Rome trip. And I mean, God, a fly on the wall and those private planes. But I was always crushed. The script was amazingly cool. And it just didn't work. You know, it was a sort of the end. No one could ever quite figure out how that movie should end. And so Warner Brothers was just like, this breaks our heart. I mean, it's George Clooney, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it would have been amazing.
Well, the problem with, movies that deal with the apocalypse is they end with the apocalypse.
That's right. You know, and everyone's version of the apocalypse is like, oh really? Like it's tough.
Yeah.
So that was one. And then the other one, Dan Levine, who was in New York and then eventually relocated to Los Angeles. He and I both love genre movies, and Jersey wasn't known for making genre movies. I mean, they would do like little comedies, like I worked with, on How High for a minute and whatever, but I mean, Their bread and butter was the Elmo Leonard, you know, Pulp Fiction, like the sort of cool, you know, that kind of tone, slick, whatever. And genre movies just wasn't their thing. But Dan found this book by this Canadian author called Lost Girls that he knew that I liked genre stuff. So he was like, if you want to be my junior. And I read the book and just loved it. And then there was a writer that I really loved. And so I had suggested that he come on and do the adaptation and sort of got all that through. So it was a real team effort between he and I. And I mean, just draft after draft after draft. And Michael Shamberg just never really liked the project and was supportive. Yeah. And Mary Parent was running Universal at the time, which is where our deal was. She just didn't get horror movies. She just didn't really like them very much. And So, you know, it had its flaws, but we had, you know, Brad Anderson was attached to direct it. And
which is crazy because Universal, I mean,
I know,
they made their...
That was
their backbone was
divorced. Yeah. And I mean, and they've certainly gotten back into that business, but I mean, she was very upfront about it, which is like, look, I want to be supportive, but it's hard. I don't see this, you know, and I can't fault her for that. I mean, she was a fabulous executive, but, so that just never, I mean, I still have all the project drafts in my garage, you know, it's that was a heartbreaker for sure. I mean, cause the book was, it reminded me of
release. Is it still doable?
You know, it's funny. I knew someone who desperately wanted to, you know, he found out that I had, you know, that I'd worked on it and was like, oh my God. I mean, there's so much money against it because, that I just think it would be impossible at this point. And the economics of horror movies have changed a lot. But the book was awesome. I mean, really awesome. Like, the character was, like, addicted to cocaine. I mean, it was just dark and funny. Reminded me of early Stephen King. I mean, the book was amazing. The author's name is Andrew Piper. So if anyone's looking for a good author, he's a good writer. So, those are the two heartbreakers.
Was there a project at the time, or maybe it was one of those that, had the most rewrites or what was the largest stack of, of a script, you know?
You know, back in those days, there were a lot of them because, you know, the economics of the business hadn't quite shifted yet. And so, you know, unfortunately for writers, the business has changed, but then, you know, it was a draft and a set. So you had you wrote the first draft, they bought the spec, you do your first rewrite, and then you'd have either two or three steps just built in. So, you know, then you do a producer's pass in between or whatever. So, I mean, you know, it wasn't unusual for at the end of a writer's contract, you'd have nine drafts of the script done.
Do you think there was an average of how many drafts you would go through per project?
Gosh.
15, 20?
No, I mean, it's changed.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think for me, my attitude towards that process has shifted. I mean, I think a lot of it is focus. You know, if you sit down with a script and you, you know, really do the work, you go through it page by page, you know, unless there are big structural problems that you're like, look, you need to change the structural problems before I can really even see the movie. And there, and that certainly happened. I mean, I would say the draft count's gone down for me over time rather than up. And maybe that's because either I pick scripts that are a little further along, or I do a little more work up front, you know what I mean? And eventually, and that's not to say that, you know, all of that stuff got made. I mean, you know, but I think people are spending money more judiciously now. So you're not getting the kind of, I'll take a flyer on this spec. I mean, the spec market's just different. So, you know, this was whatever, 17, you know, whatever, 15 years ago. So the world for writers has changed. I mean, and I also think that any agent or manager worth their salt will tell writers, you need to have a draft that's really, really polished before I even go out with it. Whereas before, I think you'd be like, an idea is good, you know, and it, development was on the brain. It's not on the brain anymore. People don't like to develop. I mean, I could get into the machinations of that. In the independent world, it's a non-paying job. So you could do draft after draft and never see a dime. In the studio world, making a movie is more expensive than developing one. But nonetheless, those budgets are getting smaller too. So, you know, it's you know, people expect those scripts to be pretty tight before they even hit market now. Whereas before, I think people would send stuff out that wasn't quite as polished.
Well, that was also back in the day when people were paying exorbitant amount of money for a 4-page treatment.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, and I came in on the very end of that, and then everything kind of went to hell in a handbasket, you know, and I think in some ways for the better. I mean, I do think that, you know, it kind of forces everyone to be a little bit more honest, not only as a writer, but as a executive, as a producer. I mean, you know, you've got to really know what your vision is. You can't, it's a little bit less agreeable, you know, you've got to kind of commit, like, this is my story. And, as opposed to like, I don't know, it could go like 17 different ways, you know, cause it just takes too much time and too much effort to try all that stuff. And that's not the way it works anymore. So.
So you were at Jersey for 4 years and then where did you go from there?
I left and I went to a place called Summit Entertainment. And this was they merged with Lionsgate. Now they're a studio. They weren't a studio. They were basically one of the largest foreign sales companies in the world. And they had a small production arm where they were going to finance their own movies through foreign sales. So no one knew what the foreign sales, I mean, certainly people who were sophisticated and kind of on the, you know, actually making films knew what foreign sales were and meant and how important they were. But by and large, in the kind of insular development world of Hollywood, no one had any idea what a foreign sales company did. So that was I was there for a little over 3 years, and we did Step Up. Step Up was there. We did Wrong Turn. I think they were finishing that when I was there. They had developed a project, but then ultimately handed it off to another company. Mr. and Mrs. Smith was a big movie that they were handling the foreign sales on. But we also did a movie that one of the, you know, there were a few movies that we financed, and one of them was originally called The Alibi, written by Noah Hawley, who is well known now for creating Fargo. But Noah wrote this script called The Alibi that I'd actually read when I was at Jersey, and we had it at Summit. And so we found these, you know, two directors, and I loved this script. It was clever. It was kind of a little bit of a throwback. And, you know, it's funny looking back on that. It's a movie that no one's ever seen. It was retitled called Lies and Alibis. I'll give you the cast. It was Steve Coogan, Rebecca Romijn, Henry Rollins, James Brolin, Selma Blair. Oh my God, I can't even believe that I'm blanking on his name right now. James Marsden. God, who else was in it? Henry Rollins was the cool one. Sam Elliott. I mean, we had the craziest cast, and we made it in LA, and I was in, I mean, I was in every step of the way in terms of us doing this, but my boss, Eric Feig, you know, was the lead producer. And then his wife gave birth to their first child 2 days before principal photography started. So he was like, I guess you're going to just deal with it. And I was like, so, you know, it was my first real heavy duty onset experience. I was so grateful. I had a wonderful line producer who I was very candid with. I was like, look, I'm like technically your boss, but I have no idea what I'm doing. So help me out. Like, help me help you. And everybody, all the crew, I mean, from hair and makeup to wardrobe, you know, everybody was gracious and wonderful to me on that set. And I the movie's, it's a great little movie, you know? I mean, honestly, like, check it out. It's called Lies and Alibis. Matt Joukowsky and Kurt Mattila were the filmmakers.
So before then, you had just sort of done the executive flyby, you know, like just stopping in and going to a set for a day here, a day there.
When we made, when I was at Jersey, they were making a smaller movie called How High, which is a pop comedy with Method Man and Redman. And Pam Abdi was the sort of the executive at Jersey who was kind of in charge of running that show. But I was sort of her shadow. So I was involved is the wrong word, but I was there. We shot at the Ambassador Hotel before they turned it down. I tore it down. And we did some stuff at UCLA. So I would go to set and, you know, we did some comedy punch up writer room stuff that I was there for, taking notes, just trying to be around, you know, but not in any real decision-making role, you know, but it wasn't my first experience, but I mean, to literally wake up every day and know that where I was going was set was new. And amazing. I mean, and I say to anyone, I'm like that I got more out of that movie than it got out of me, but it was a great lesson. And I wouldn't have had that experience anywhere else. I mean, going to a company like Summit, which was a little bit of a shift because Jersey was a big, sexy, you know, production company with a big studio deal, and no one knew who Summit was, but it was, it allowed me to be a lot more entrepreneurial and really get my hands dirty in a way a lot of executives at my level never would have had the chance. So then I left there and I sort of reached that point where I was kind of ready to do something more, and there was only so much room at Summit. And so this new division was opening up, and my friend Dan Levine from my earlier story had worked for Dimension. And so when Dimension kind of did its thing and sort of disbanded, and you know, Brad Weston went to Paramount and Andrew Rona sort of doing whatever, and they were the co-heads of Dimension, and Dan worked for them. So he went with Brad to Paramount and said, hey, you know, I know you've reached out, let me know you're looking for a job, you should meet with Andrew. He's running this new thing over at Universal.
Yeah.
So I went and I interviewed with him, and basically they'd resurrected this old label that they had called Rogue Pictures. And so I couldn't believe I got the job. It was literally my dream job. Like, all they did was make genre movies. And
for you, when you say genre, you sort of focus on horror.
I focus on horror.
And so that's what you loved and, you know, wanted
like,
to.
Also, you know, we did, comedies. Like, genre movies are usually ones where you can, you know, whether it's a thriller or a comedy or a horror film or, you know, an action movie. Those are all kind of considered genre movies. So we kind of ran the gamut on that, but my focus was always kind of horror, thrillers, action. I used to call them boy movies, totally sexist, but I did. And so I was senior vice president of production at Rogue, which was a studio, and I'd never worked for like a legitimate buyer before. And so that was kind of fun. And I was there for 3.5 years, and then the entire world collapsed. But while I was there, it was fun because I was able to kind of work with a lot of the writers that I had cultivated and gotten to know and just not really been in a position to do stuff with, and or I was at companies that didn't want to deal with genre movies, but I always remembered them. And so kind of it became a lot of those faces were sort of familiar, or names were familiar to me over the years. And so I was sort of finally in a place where I was like, this is relevant. This is a relevant job to sort of this Rolodex that I'd built up. And, you know, and we made, I mean, I was sort of the executive in charge of 3 movies while I was there. I did the remake of The Hitcher with Platinum Dunes. I did The Unborn with Platinum Dunes. And then I did Fighting, which actually was Channing Tatum, who obviously had been sort of discovered when I was at Summit on Step Up. And Kevin Mischer was the producer on Fighting. But you know, it was great. I mean, it was a really great experience. You know, there were other movies that got made that I wasn't sort of, you know, I was on the Platinum and Dunes account because I was the most senior person there. And that was the biggest sort of producer deal that we had. But I was kind of bummed because I loved Neil Marshall, who had done a movie called The Descent, and he did Doomsday for us, which I always call like just a lovely mess of a movie. Like I do. I love that movie. I mean, the vigor and enthusiasm in which he directed that film was so amazing. So I really wanted to work on that. You know, The Strangers was a movie that I fought for and then ultimately got pulled off of and did something else. But it's where I met Brian Bertino, who's my current business partner. And we did Last House on the Left, which was a remake of the Wes Craven movie, which I was involved in the director decisions, but then ultimately it wasn't my movie. Alex Heineman sort of came in and handled those. But I thought, you know, Dennis Iliadis, who directed it, did an unbelievable job. And I'll be very honest, like Andrew said, you know, who thinks we should remake this movie? Raise your hand. And my hand didn't go up. But seeing what Dennis did with that film made it relevant. And I loved it. So, you know, we did some fun stuff there, even though I wasn't sort of as directly involved in those movies as I would have liked to. But, you know, again, it was great. And when the economic collapse happened in 2008,
yeah.
You know, the company got sold. And so I was sort of left without a job. And there were a lot of other people in town out of work. And so I thought, I could compete for, you know, no jobs with people who are more senior than me who are taking step downs because there's no work. Or I could take a chance and do what I came here to do, which is to produce and be as close to the projects as possible. Because that was the thing that was always a bummer, was that I was always one step removed. I was the suit, so to speak. Or I was the junior or whatever. Right. I was like, well, and Brian and I developed a friendship and we realized that we had a very similar approach to material, and he's a writer director, and we liked talking about story, and I felt that he had the ability to actually analyze other people's work without any ego or arrogance. And he always respected the notes that I had given him over the course of our working relationship. And so we sort of talked about how it would be fun for us to open a production company that would fill what we perceive to be a void in the marketplace. You know, Platinum Dunes was doing sort of the bigger budget kind of remake glossy horror films. Jason Blum hadn't really emerged, but had started to emerge and doing kind of his thing. But there weren't really anybody at the time, at least any big players that we felt were servicing kind of the writer driven horror film, and, you know, where story was king. And, you know, the 70s movies that inspired us both, whether it's the Shining, you know, 70s, early 80s, whether it's The Shining or The Exorcist, or, you know, one of Brian's huge influences is the original Texas Chainsaw.
Right.
You know, and just looking and saying, you know, we want to make movies that actually have an impact, that are frightening, that don't laugh at the genre. And that starts with the script. And so we really became a development-oriented production company. And so, you know, it took a while. But last year we made two movies. A24 bought both of them. We have a movie that hopefully will go this year with Screen Gems. And, you know, we produced a movie alongside Jason Blum, I think 3.5-4 years ago. And so, you know, we're it's the little engine that could. We have another movie with Jason Blum that we're not sort of day on, that Akiva Goldsman's directing. So, you know, I think what we learned was if you focus on the script and you protect the story, your road is harder. I don't think we counted on it taking this long, but I think eventually kind of good material does prevail. And so, you know, we've made 4 movies in you know, the last 4 years, and they've all been challenges, but I think at the end of the day, we're really proud that we did protect the stories,
right.
You know, and even at the expense of making a living.
well, three out of 4 of those movies were done by writer directors, and then the 4th was it a team or was it?
You mean Stephanie?
Stephanie.
Yeah. So Ben Collins and Luke Petrowski are the writing team that wrote the original draft, and they were not directors. So we had gone and were looking for a filmmaker, and then, you know, Jason had gotten a hold of the script and just sent it to Akiva, who liked it, and then they contacted us and said, you know, we want to do this. And
how does it differ between working with somebody that's a writer-director and then, you know, somebody that's just a writer? I mean, do you feel like there's much of a difference when you're in the script stage, or, and then it just shifts when you go to production, like when they put on their different hat, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you can, there, you know, I've worked with a lot of writer-directors, but I've also, you know, in my earlier life, when I was sort of more in the development ranks, it was more common to work with a writer and then hire a director. I mean, I think that, you know, when you're in the independent world, I really like working with a writer-director because, you know, you have the sort of package all built into one. I find that this, you know, the scripts, you can pull a movie together sort of more easily if you have a writer-director, or not easy, it's not more easily, it's quicker, because you don't have to go through the steps of being like, okay, the script's ready and now I got to find a director. You know, they're kind of the same, they're the same person. So, but in terms of the writing, you know, the only thing I will say, and this is unfair to non-writer director writers, but, you know, the two writer directors, you know, Oz Perkins, who'd never directed anything before. I mean, we convinced Oz to direct, not convinced, but we said, Oz, you should direct your script. And he was like, well, I never really thought anyone would ever let me. And, you know, our thing is, well, maybe they won't, but, you know, you should, we think you have a great, compelling story and we'll support that. So, you know, 4 years later, eventually we were right. It took a long time. But, you know, the thing about that was the script was so personal to him. You know, his vision was so baked into every page, you know? And so when you could sit him down with someone and it made sense, because that what he was talking about, you could read on the page. So I like that, because it's just, you know, you're speaking with a singular point of view. But I think that also, you know, working with a writer who isn't a director, you know, directors have a different vision sometimes. And that can be frustrating as a producer, especially such a story-oriented producer, because I just want a director to be like, yes, the script is great, let's go do it, you know, and most directors have notes. So that's always a challenge in which to navigate, you know. And because we're so instrumental in developing, you know, we're so involved in developing the work that we become very invested in it. So it's not, you know, it's not just the director, you know, quote, criticizing the writer. It's like he's criticizing us because we're like, you know, you get invested in it. But so I don't think, you know, the only advantage, it just depends. I mean, you know, if a writer writes a good script, it's a good script.
Right.
And if they want to direct it and they have all the other stuff, and, you know, some of that's tangible and some of it's intangible, that's great, you know. But if they don't, then, you know, you find a director who loves the script as much as you do, and then, you know, you all become kind of a family. I mean, you know, it's I don't know. I mean, I on the development side, I don't think it matters, because you're just dealing with the script at that point, you know. Right. And by the time a director comes on, the sort of script part of it is done. So even if it's the same person, you're still putting on a different hat, you know? And the way that we like to work is I like the script to be as ready as possible before you're getting into that stage. So that's not to say that, you know, you're not tinkering with stuff, but by and large, I like things to be kind of pretty much as they're going to be before we get there. So.
Very cool.
That's my feeling on writers and writers and directors.
You love them all.
I do. I mean, I think storytelling is both a craft and a genuine God-given talent. I mean, and when you read a good script, you know, there's nothing like it, you know. And even if it's not a movie I ever think I can get made, I still enjoy reading a good script. You know, they're nice, compact stories, and if they're well written, I can picture them in my head, you know. And so it's like free movies all the time in their own weird way. So
Well, I think that's a great note to end on.
Yeah.
So thank you for sitting down with me today.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I hope, you know, I don't know, is this inspirational and interesting to someone who might, you know, want to come and join us on one of our retreats?
All right.
All right. Thanks, Brian.
All right. Thanks.